welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day. It's Brian and Nisha today. So let's get to our guests. We'd like to welcome Lane Hensley. Welcome to Drive Through HR.
Hey, thanks for having me. I love the entry song, by the way. That got the mood up. I like it.
Hey, well, that's it just puts a smile on my face. I don't know, just something about our portfolio that makes me laugh. So it tends to make my day a little bit brighter also. So, well, if you would, let's kick it off. Have you introduced yourself to our millions of listeners, and then we'll kind of roll from there.
All right, awesome. Thanks for the intro. So my name is Lane Hensley, and for the last 21 years, I've been leading and running and founded a company called Odyssey Teams with my business partner, Bill John, with the primary objective of creating like profound sort of life-altering experiences, quite honestly. I mean, Odyssey, our definition of Odyssey is a journey marked with notable occurrences. And of course, in the HR world or business world or educational world, it is a sense of an odyssey, and there's a few notable occurrences that happen along the way that sort of align us to who we're going to become, what kind of person we are. You know, did we return the money if we got a little extra at a store, or did we pretend it didn't happen? You know, do we cheat at board games? You know, who knows what? And along the way, we learn these life lessons, and we create powerful training activities and conversations that help crystallize that for people and companies.
Well, that is a great introduction, and we can get into the whole. Actually, I have one specific question I want to make sure and get into, making a note here before the end of the show, around kind of that individual integrity thing or thought process or kind of that. So just a mental note there. So kind of rolling into what's top of mind, what keeps you up at night currently?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And, you know, in my intro there, as I was kind of tipping into what we were trying to do, you know, and now along the way, we've worked with, you know, Wharton Business School, UCLA, Microsoft, you know, you name it, all these companies. And playing into the idea of what keeps me up at night is this level of how do we engage people, how do we remind them that their contribution matters. There seems to be such a sort of life experience that gets us to a place where it's like, you know, I'll just sit back, I'll let somebody else notice, I'll let somebody else speak up. And we kind of learn it from that evolution of from kindergarten to 12th grade, let's say. From, you know, as a kindergartner, we feel like, you know, we should raise our hand every time we have something to contribute, you know, we matter, we'll volunteer, we'll do anything. And then we sort of learn along the way that, hey, if I don't get it right, that doesn't feel very good. And if I get it right all the time, that doesn't feel very good. So by senior year in high school, I'm just going to sit back and sort of be what we call a prisoner or a victim. And the learning that our sort of physiology goes through as far as what happens after we take a risk, if something good doesn't happen next, then we don't take risk anymore. And we sort of learn to be so skeptical that then when we, you know, get our dream job and we show up in a career and we say, hey, I'm so happy to be working here. And somebody who's worked there for a while looks at the new employee and says, oh, yeah, you must be new. Or, you know, you say, hey, I work for Bob. You know, he's my manager. And someone's like, oh, well, talk to me in 6 months. You know, that really starts to influence the way people see their environment. I call it when somebody walks in your mind with their dirty feet. And it really clouds the optimism, it clouds the sense of, you know, the possibility that I could be in a place where it's safe for me to contribute again, take risks, stretch myself, share my ideas, you know, and all of that. And I think that that's a big challenge for HR, leadership, managers, everybody.
Well, and it's such, I mean, you were in such a fascinating space because it's, you know, when you start mixing in kind of the, and then I'll get to my question, personal and professional persona and kind of decision-making criteria. I personally, I don't think there should be a lot of duality in that. I think it should be kind of on point. You are who you are, and I think that's you live a happier life when you do that. So as you're starting to talk about people kind of, you know, kind of getting into your mix, so to speak, when you guys have clients and you're talking to people, how do you help people kind of discern, like, what they need to be every day when they show up for whatever they're doing, whether it's work or an event or just in general. Is that a conversation you have on a regular basis?
Yeah, absolutely. I like what you said, that basically, you know, that persona and who we become is consistent, whether it's at home or on a tennis court or in the boardroom or, you know, in some sort of leadership training or just a team development program. It's like everybody, you have sort of these reflexive, we call them reflexive tendencies. So we coined this idea of like the art of leadership. So the ART stands for aware of your reflexive tendencies. And it could be the art of teamwork or the art of sales or whatever it is, because we do develop all these reflexive tendencies. Some of them we're just born with. You know, you might just be naturally super funny, or you're going to be a certain height, or you're going to be this kind of personality. But a lot of them we learn through this, you know, life experience. And those reflexive tendencies can become so subconscious for us that we can't get ourselves out of those reflexes. Therefore, we can't create new results in our relationships or in our the way we show up in a team or the way we sell or the way we lead or whatever it is. So we call it, you know, catching yourself being yourself. So how can I, as a leader, and in our work, our objective is to have teams or individuals have an opportunity to pause long enough and learn how to pause in the midst of a busy life, pause long enough to recognize the situation and if needed, apply some knowledge and adapt a new behavior to get a better result, instead of feeling like, oh, I'm so busy, the pressure's on, this meeting's going long, so I'll just cut off everybody who's trying to give their ideas and we'll get on to the work. And what they do in those reflexive tendencies creates the story everybody tells about them, whether they're open to new ideas or not, whether they're the kind of leader that listens or the kind of person on a team that supports new ideas or whatever it is. And if we can create in our trainings, our objective is to have people at the end actually apply knowledge. I mean, that's the dream, right? Not only that you just have the knowledge, but you have the ability to apply it in a real-time life situation. And so we practice that through our sessions as far as helping them learn to catch themselves being themselves, recognize the reflexive tendencies they have, evaluate whether my reflexive tendency is going to get me a good result in this situation or not. And, of course, HR people in the nuts and bolts of their jobs have to do that all the time when it comes to harassment or, you know, equal opportunity situations where you, you know, look at what you're about to do and go, hey, is this going to fall within the guidelines of our company? But it happens in a real personal and organic way as well when it comes to, you know, if we're pausing long enough to listen to our customer, or are we checking our phone to see if we got a text from somebody who doesn't really matter at them in that moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course, Lane. That's really interesting. And going back to your first point of engaging people, you know what? And as you talked about the reality is always not actually exciting. You know what? Sometimes it can be a lot of high moments. Sometimes it can be low moments. But it's actually finding a balance between the two, right? So
absolutely.
So how are you helping your clients in terms of engaging their employees in their real life?
Yeah, well, you know, everybody, I think, along the way in their career has a moment where, you know, a customer comes to them or coworker says, hey, by the way, you're my mentor. You know, by the way, what you did for me when, you know, everybody else in your company said they couldn't deliver and you took my project, you pushed it through and you got it done. Thank you. They have a moment where they realize their contribution matters. So in our programs, if we can have people have an opportunity to pause and sort of hit the reset button. And actually, my degree is in HR and in recreation. Now, recreation, people think of volleyballs and beach balls and, you know, whatever. And the term recreation means to recreate anew. That's what the definition means, to recreate anew. So how do you get people to pause, recognize their reflexive tendencies, have an opportunity to recreate anew, and then when you've got a room of 40 or 50 or 2,000 people, and you are, if you're participating in one of our philanthropic workshops, then at the end of all of the content and all the practice, we do something like we build a brand new bicycle, and they're charged to come up with a presentation for that bike, and they think, you know, a sales pitch, right? Well, when we open up the doors and 100 kids come in to represent the customer and they actually give the bikes to them, or we build the prosthetic hands and then we show them a video of the hands being distributed throughout the world. And we've got over 13,000 hands in 67 countries we've distributed that have been built in our programs. That crystallizes the why of the work, the value that, you know what, although real life does feel like it happens slow and sometimes I'm in my cubicle and I'm working away and I forget that somewhere down the line there's a customer that's life is going to be better. They're going to be able to do their job better and deliver their services better if I do a good job in this moment, this little fork in the road that's right in front of me. And without remembering the why of our work, then it feels like we're just going through the motions sometimes. It feels like we're supposed to apply new knowledge just because my boss told me or because that will help the company get to its sales goal. And those sales goals and that what the boss tells me doesn't really matter when none of those people are around. If I have lost sight of the why of my work, that real foundational core of I know the value I provide to these customers out there or to the world in some greater cause, and I recognize that that's me fulfilling the call for my life. And when we do that in a room with a whole bunch of people, then you feel the entire the culture take a step up and everybody's awareness around how can we support each other to provide the very best culture, the very best product, the very best service, the very best story for our brand out there to the world. And it has to happen everybody together so that we've all sort of recreated anew the way we see each other, the way we see our role, and the way we see our reflexive patterns playing a role in telling that story going forward.
Cool. That's such an interesting concept. You're not just doing a team building activity, but at the same time you are supporting to the community as well by involving the employees in that organization, which is a great way in terms of, you know, building connection between the people. But at the same time, for our audience, those of who are listening right now, who doesn't know about your company, I'd like to get your takes on, you know, how is that conversation going on, especially from a company who are not yet involved into this kind of a team building or leadership activities, but they really wanted to do this at their organization, and they are approaching you. So how is that conversation going on? Share us some of your experiences, some of your aha moments, or some of your, real conversation with your client.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at the foundation of it, we know that our memory is linked to our emotion. You might drive the same way to work every day, but the day you got pulled over or the day you got in a car accident, you know exactly where it was, you know everything about it because your brain said, hey, make a note. This felt good. This felt bad. This was whatever. And when you drive down the road, if someone's in the car with you, you tell them, I got in an accident right here, or I got a ticket right here, because your emotional memory reminds you of that. So when a client comes to us and says, hey, you know, we need you guys to come in and work with our team. We just need some team building. I say, well, if your team needs building, then what's wrong with it right now? They say, well, we have a new boss. We just restructured. We have a new sales strategy. I say, okay, now we're getting to the interesting part. And I say, well, what's the current story going on? Well, they don't like the new boss, or they don't like the new structure, or they feel like they're not going to have enough time to deliver the best service. So we start looking at, okay, well, what's the emotional trigger that's going on in the team right now? And for some of them, it ends up in what we call an if-then statement. They say, if I apply this new structure, then what? And if the answer to that is something negative, so if I work in this new collaborative sales environment, then I'll have to go to more meetings, I'll have more people that I can't trust that are helping me reach my sales goal, then blank and blank and blank. So we have to reprogram that if-then statement. And when we start to design the workshop, if we can get people to a point where they're recognizing those reflexive conversations, they're listening to that little voice in their head, and they start to say, okay, I do have some negative if-then statements that are leading me to the wrong result. So we want to provide the best possible content. We call it like head, hands, and hearts. So give them something to think about, give them something to do, and give them something to feel that's all in alignment with the message. So our client might come to us, let's say, for example, I just worked with Microsoft, all the new hires from around the world, And we know that they're coming into a very high pressure work environment. They're graded quite heavily on their performance. There's a huge restructure going on. So they want to be sure that they recognize their influence on the culture of Microsoft going forward, that they recognize the value of these new hires out of college because we need to be more current as an organization. And they also recognize that they're going to be working side by side with people who have been there in 5 and 10 years. So we say, great, let's build the conversation. So we give them something to think about so they're prepared intellectually for that environment. Give them something to do. So we might do the Life Cycles program or something where they can practice coming together, problem solving, create a powerful product, and then give them something to feel when the kids come in. They're reminded that Microsoft's one of the most incredible companies in the world as far as what they've done technology-wise. They've done more philanthropically for the world probably than any other company. They're continuing to try to break new ground with their technology and have more impact on third world countries as well as this country, people doing business. So it feels great, although every day at Microsoft doesn't feel like this day. We need to have an emotional reminder that it could feel like this. It does feel like this out there. And although you might be a programmer in some cubicle somewhere, you're doing something that is changing the world. And don't get so head down doing your job that you forget about that final result.
Nice. So let me do a quick reset. Everybody, you're listening to Drive Through HR. We're on with Lane Hensley. Lane, there's a question that there's a concept that I've thought about for a long time, and I didn't know really where to place it. And for some reason, I want to ask you, because I think you might have an interesting take on it.
Great, bring it on.
Hey, there we go. So no more softballs. It's curve. Hi, this is inside curveball coming at you. So how do you place people kind of from where, maybe like in the shoes buckets is the terminology. So how do you place people in different buckets? Somebody who decides to take the stairs versus take the escalator, going up but not coming down. Do you guys go through on your side some of that abstract stuff of, God, I wonder why people do these things, and I wonder if that gets to why they're happy, why they're satisfied, why they're engaged and committed. Is that part of what you guys internally talk about and figure out and share within your programs potentially?
Absolutely. And it's all about, you know, picking the right content to support the story. So like the escalator is an awesome example. And actually there's a YouTube video, and I can't remember how to find it right now, but if you look up like piano staircase probably versus escalator, these people actually turn a staircase into a piano. And they do the hidden cameras, and as you step up it, you hear it go bong, 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 bong. You know, you hear, and people take the staircase a lot more than the escalator in this experiment. And they say, you know, 38% more people took the stairs. I can't remember the exact number. But the idea is that it tips people's curiosity. It's still the path of more resistance, right? And the escalator versus stairs is a simple fork in the road, and we like to keep things what we call on the cutting edge of common sense, meaning, look, you can see the difference here. The stairs might be better for you because you need a little fitness and you get yourself up there and all the other reasons, but the escalator is easier. So if I'm in the fork in the road, when do I choose the path of least resistance and when do I choose the more difficult path? And whatever you have to do, and I mean whatever you have to do, to light the spark in somebody, to recognize when they're at that fork in the road and recognize, if I choose this more difficult path, what's going to be the reward for me? And that's the choice. And if they see what the reward is and it's personal enough, they'll do it. Or most people are taking the escalator, looks easy, I'm going to do it. And that's where you get people talking negatively at the water cooler about, you know, Sally or Bob or whoever was at the meeting who had a new idea. Because it's easy to stand at the water cooler and talk badly about somebody. It's harder to walk up and hear that conversation and go, hey, you guys, I was at the meetings yesterday, and one of our company values is that we trust each other and we respect each other for diverse opinions. And we're not doing that right now. Can you imagine walking up to a group of people and doing that? That's like taking the stairs. But it will wake them up because emotionally they might, you know, now talk badly about you, but you get to walk away going, you know what, I stepped into the role that I need to play to be in alignment with who I want to become and with the values of this organization. And like a beautiful sunset, you know what? It's going to be a beautiful sunset whether you're there to appreciate it or not. And you need to do what's powerful and in line with your integrity, whether people appreciate it or not. And I think that there's a very clear sort of opportunity to say, between the stairs and the escalator, what are you going to choose in this moment? And recognizing the return on that investment for you personally and organizationally, what it does to a culture.
So what is your take on, your definition and take on culture? That's such a big, sometimes omnipresent word.
Yeah, culture, and like I said in the very beginning, when you played that music, your intro music, it's like it starts the culture. People who are listening, they felt better, like instantly. They feel it. Culture is mood, and it's really difficult to build something beautiful on a bad mood. And culture, in our workshops, we do exercises that magnify the amount of influence that if there's 500 people in a room, we create a culture in a 10-minute activity, and everybody sees, wow, we did that because everybody was doing that. We did that. I felt the mood shift because of my own individual contribution to my partner and how that rubbed off on the people around me. Culture is, like you say, it's this massive thing. At the same time, if we wake people up to their contribution, they realize it's a very personal and individual thing that happens between you and the person who's in the cubicle next to you, maybe, that then influences the people around them. And when you remind people about their sphere of control versus their sphere of influence and how we all have an influence on the culture, that story, like I said, people walk in your mind with their dirty feet. Well, when we cloud up what people choose to see in the culture, then that reflexive tending toward negativity can take over. And we all face this individually. Like Jimmy Kimmel, I think, has a joke. He says they invented a robot that can identify itself in a mirror, but it won't truly be human until it learns to hate what it sees. That's a very sad reality, that when we look at something and we're not looking for what's beautiful and what's healthy about our culture, we'll tend to see what's negative. And in an organization, that can become the story that most people are telling, unless you get a few people inspired to be that spark and say, hey, we can rise above this. Yeah, it's a tough business environment. Yes, we just went through something tough, but hey, let's focus on what's positive and let's recognize our own influence on that greater culture. And that's when you feel real power shift, when the culture shifts, and then that get that mood up, then you can build great things on top of that positive mood. But I want to be clear that this isn't about just being touchy-feely, like busy work for grown-ups, because that's the hard part. See, some people think, oh, we want a team building, we need to get our people together, but then they have too much just experience where they felt a lot, but it wasn't connected to anything. In the HR world and in the human behavior world, you've got to connect people to an emotion, but make sure that's built on why it's important for us to show up like this, this, or this together, and not just have it like, oh, that was really fun, but that was really fun, and it showed me why it's important for me to, show up to my meeting a little different next week, or listen a little differently to my customer instead of just reflexively go, oh, that's, Karen, my customer, that's never going to agree with me. And we have those reflexive conversations that happen in our minds.
That's interesting, Lane. And I'm sure you might be having a lot of different tools or training, which is suitable for different environment and different culture. So I wanted to have your take on how is that conversation going on with your clients in terms of deciding which training tool to be used for this particular culture of the company, or how hard it is to change the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And, for sure, people vary in their readiness. It's very difficult to change a culture that's existed for a long time and that you've got some of those sort of, undefined leaders that you've got to win them over, right? You've got to get those leaders that are leading in the negative direction. And you also have to consider the culture. This Helping Hands project where we build these prosthetic hands, if you go to our website, odysseyteams.com, you can actually purchase a build-a-hand kit, and you can facilitate this program for yourself. So a contact I worked with a number of years ago, Johnson Controls, is now positioned in China, and she bought a few of these kits and facilitated the workshop in China. And what you see, no matter where we are, we've done these in India, China, Australia, all over Europe, Western Europe, I mean, you name it, these concepts cut through to the humanity of everybody, and it hits a consistent chord, which is, you know, I want to remember that I matter. I don't like the way the culture is going either. I want to feel like I've got a voice in it, but I can't do this alone. And that's where you, when you get a team together and you have everybody see sort of the other side of the rainbow, like at the same time, they go, oh my gosh, I have hope again. Because without hope, you're really lost. I mean, hope is like the foundational sort of belief, like, you know what, things are bad now, but I hope it can get better, and I know I'm a part of that. And now I've seen it enough where I'm going to put some pressure on myself to choose next time I'm at the fork in the road instead of letting it happen by chance. And it's happened everywhere. Now, of course, I want every team to walk out like having a personality transplant and go from like this negative place where nobody wants to work with really high turnover to, you know, the number one group in the company that everybody's saying, what did you guys do? And we've had that happen after our programs. But, you know, any step in the forward or progress or improving direction is a step. And we have to be patient because, you know, none of us fail overnight. None of us succeed overnight. It's a collection of a long-term investment that if we sustain new behaviors over time, we'll find ourselves in a whole new environment. And it has to start somewhere, though. And we believe this is absolutely the formula to start that.
Lane, what's your, and this is, we've got about two and a half minutes left. What is your take on kind of the movement around CSR, the, you know, corporate social responsibility?
Yeah, well, you know, even when we started our social responsibility programs, nobody even knew what that meant. Nobody, we'd say philanthropy, and they'd be like, I'm sorry, what does that mean? And so we've really seen a movement, and with these Gen Yers coming in, the next generations, everybody wants to feel like I don't work for the big, bad, evil Darth Vader empire called, you know, XY giant company. They want to know that, you know what, if we're successful, we give back, and we give back through our work. So the participants, your people, are becoming more and more in tune with, do we do runs for the benefit groups? Are we involved in philanthropy? Is this a company that I can support because they're, you know, sustainable in lots of ways? You know, how can I feel like I'm connecting my wagon to an organization that isn't aligned with who I want to be? You know, people don't have those same allegiances to corporations anymore. You know, they want to be proud when they hand their business card out to a friend at a cocktail party, and they don't look at them like going, oh, you work for, you know, that oil company or something. They want to know that, yeah, yes, we work for an oil company, but look at all the good we do, not only with our products, with our research, and with the environment, but also beyond that. And that's really important for building that culture and building the support from the inside out of a company instead of just from the outside in, from the customer. It's becoming really important that it go both directions.
Sure. Yeah, you got to be careful. Texas and Oklahoma, we're definitely energy states. I mean, want to make sure my car's outside, so we don't mess with them too much.
I mean, I work a lot with Shell, Exxon, you name it, and there's great people in there doing great work, and I hate that story doesn't get out more often because of that negativity taking over.
Yeah, it's, you know, and there's some companies that I've got a lot of friends that work with ConocoPhillips, and I know that that's a big component of the research and just all the great things they do. But, yeah, so totally get that. So we got about one last thing. How can people connect with you, your organization? And after that, we're done. We're out of here. Great show.
All right, awesome. Thank you for having me on. Certainly our website, Odyssey, ODYSSEYTEAMS, so teams plural, .com, and that's where you find everything, the Build a Hand kit, the life cycles, the bike building programs, our Helping Hands workshops. And we have lots of, like, assessment tools and things like that, but most of those aren't promoted. The website's really the gateway drug to get people to understand the value and the impact of our work.
Perfect. Lane, thanks for coming on. Folks, we're out of here.